You're listening to Dr. Finn Pollard and colleagues on Siren FM with Past Prologue.
The word is about, there's something evolving. Whatever may come, the world keeps revolving. They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
Apparently nobody really knows when Harold Macmillan first said events, dear boy, events. It could have been to President Kennedy, it could have been to a journalist. It could, according to various sources, have actually been to foreign policy, basically. Dennis Healy, I think, said it was all about foreign policy, his different party. I'm just ruminating on that, Finn, because events, dear boy, events is pretty much what we're in, because this edition of Past Prologue goes out literally the day before we may or may not be part of the European Union, who have left it, or be still part of it.
And we probably won't know until the last possible moment.
But what better way to actually launch Past Prologue for the fantastic year of 2019 than with three awesome individuals, of whom the world basically is just a little bit better for having all their presences in there. Over to you, Finn.
It absolutely is. We have with us today Philip Hoskin, Ian Packer and Andrew Defty, and we are thinking about party splits.
Indeed, and we're not inviting the listener to actually do the splits whilst actually listening to the whole thing, or indeed engage in a banana split at the same time.
That could all be very nasty.
Over to you, Finn. I think you'd like to speak to Philippa.
So, as regular listeners will know, we like to try and draw some links, not only with recent events, but by going back into the medieval period. And so I asked Philippa whether there might be some applicable aspect of medieval history we could think about in relation to party splits. And she suggested we might talk about Henry III and Simon de Montfort. So could I ask you, first of all, to set the scene a bit for us? Who were these two characters?
Yeah, right. I think the best thing to do is think about 1258. 1258 is when Simon de Montfort, who is Earl of Leicester, and also actually French, he's not been living in England all his life, but he's Earl of Leicester now, leads a rebellion against Henry III at Parliament. He has the backing of a large number of members of the nobility, large number of the barons. They manage to have certain members of Henry's family forced out of the country. And they also manage to get some control over the king. They have a statement called the Provisions of Oxford, which is basically a statement about how the country should be ruled. 1260, of course, Henry III fights back. In 1264, Simon de Montfort wins a battle, a major battle against him. It looks as though he really has won. His party, his faction has won. But unfortunately, the party falls apart. It splits, it breaks up, and in 1266, that's going to lead to Simon de Montfort in a battle of Evesham, literally losing his head and actually many other parts of his body as they hack him apart.
At least we haven't beheaded anyone in the current scenario yet. What had gone wrong in the rule of Henry III that had led to this rebellion in the first place?
Well, Henry III is what you'd call a bad king. There are many aspects to that. He is terrible at military in battles. He's a terrible military leader. He's terrible with money. At one stage, he has large numbers of creditors circling the tower, so he can't leave. But what he's really done, because this is really a one-issue rebellion, is he started handing the cash that he doesn't have and the positions and honours that other people want over to his relatives, his French relatives, who have taken over the court, basically.
But is there a sense in which it's actually, is it a sort of a collision between two groups of Frenchmen then on, as it were, on English soil, if de Montfort is also of relatively recent French extraction?
In some ways, yes. I mean, the nobility in 13th century England speak French anyway. A lot of them have French land. A lot of them have French ancestors. And there is a feeling that de Montfort has become English by accepting his English property. But essentially, yes, it's two groups of Frenchmen arguing in English over English rights and English property.
And does de Montfort have a plan for how to put the government back on an even keel? In, you know, if the king is the problem and he's going to remove the king, what follows from that?
Well, he does and he doesn't. He has a very long document that declares that the king is going to stay in power but be guided by a council, that the rights of the church will be upheld, that people will have justice. But saying the rights of the church and justice are not very clear statements. And that's a lot of the problem. That's enough to get people together in 1258. A big battle is enough to get people together in 1264 and to renew the idea that we're going to have justice in the kingdom. But there's not a lot underpinning it, which means it begins to mean different things to different people. Everyone sees it differently. And that's where things start to fall apart.
Is there any kind of structure to work within? I mean, how much... presumably the king is... all powerful at this point, and Parliament, insofar as it is there, has a limited ability to restrain him anyway.
Parliament is called when it's needed to approve taxes, basically. The problem is that the king has to keep calling it because he's at war. And that gives the barons the chance to meet together, and it gives them the chance to feel that they really do have some power over the king, because if they don't approve taxation, the king cannot collect taxes. He doesn't do it on a regular basis. And so they have negotiating points. De Montfort calls Parliament far more often than the king does when he, from between 1264 and 1266, when he's really in power. But, of course, that's a problem as well, because he also gives the barons negotiating points against him. That's a chance for his faction to faction, if you like.
So how many, do you have a lot of factions in Parliament when he calls it? Is it a lot of individuals all against each other? Or do they form into any kind of sort of recognisable groups?
They start to form into recognisable groups under de Montfort. In 1258, basically, it's people who do not like the king and they can all be together. And that's great. In 1264, it's people who have defeated the king and they can all be together. But de Montfort is interested mostly in keeping his family in order, in giving his sons, of whom he has several, what they want. So he doesn't pay attention to what's going on outside. And that means he doesn't pay attention to the fact that every baron who joined him had their own thing they wanted back from the king. When the king's son, Edward, escapes, actually, from de Montfort's captivity, he's a rallying point. So there is a point around which people can focus against de Montfort.
So we've actually got a situation where de Montfort ends up doing what he's accused the king of doing then. Because if I've understood this right, the king is busy saying, or the charge against the king is he's giving out all these things to his own family. And then de Montfort takes power and then proceeds to do pretty much the same thing.
Yes, and I think at first he doesn't care much about that because he thinks every baron is for themselves, because the problem is when your splits have a leader, and that's what they get in Edward.
Is it to do with the fact that de Montfort is not very good at managing people once he's in that position of greater authority? Could a different figure in that role at that time have held together these competing groups more successfully, do you think? Or is it just that actually the factional nature of the barons is such that it's always going to disintegrate?
I suspect it's always going to disintegrate because they are not clear what they want. They are just clear what they don't want.
No parallels.
But Simon is not that good with people either. He's really quite good at being an inspiring leader who leads a rebellion, but he's not very good at dealing with people on a day-to-day basis after that.
And is there also a sort of long-standing problem that in the end you've got in the king a figure with a whole kind of myth and a sort of a religious dimension around it, which means that even if you sideline him, that still exerts a sort of authority that you're never really going to be able to overcome?
Yes, I mean, always the baron's fiction is we are not overthrowing the king, we are just helping him away from those evil advisers. And the fact that Edward is the king's son, is the next king, can be crowned king, gives him the ability to lead the opposition. And Edward is also good with people. He goes on as king to prove that he knows how to negotiate people, he knows how to deal with grievances.
So has much changed? Because I presume then, once de Montfort has lost his head, the sort of monarchy is restored to its old order and Edward will succeed Henry.
It doesn't immediately change because Henry takes back over, but he's only there for about 5 more years before he dies. Under Edward, things do change. Edward knows to call Parliament more frequently, to ask his barons' advice, and he particularly invents something called private petitioning. Any person in the country can send a private request to government for anything that they want, and government will listen to them.
That must create a lot of paperwork.
It does, and most of the time, of course, they say, go back and ask the locals. But people feel that they can do it. It's my party and I'll cry if I want to, cry if I want to, cry if I want to. You would cry too if it happened to you. Nobody knows where my Johnny has got it, but Judy left the same time. Why was he holding her hand when he's supposed to be?
Leslie Gore crying or saying she might cry at her own party. So we're going to come forward a bit in time to the 19th and 20th centuries, but staying in Britain and turn to Ian Packer. When I was sort of discussing with you where we might start, you suggested we needed to think first of all about the difference between splits and splinters.
Yes. I think when people talk about parties splitting, I think what they're usually talking about is a reasonably large section of a party moving away from the main section of the party, or indeed the party splitting in half. A splinter is just a few people leaving. And splinters happen a lot in politics, particularly in British politics, where the two-party system, which has been predominant in some form or other since, well, at least the 1830s and 1840s, means that lots of people of fairly disparate views are gathered into the two main parties. So there's always going to be a risk that at least some people are going to be upset and going to leave. But, of course, the other side of the two-party system is that there's a very strong incentive for most people in both of those two main parties to stick together, because that's the best way to be able to win an election and form a government, if you all stick together. So splinters happen quite a lot, but splits tend to be quite rare.
So are we right in thinking, therefore, that splits are, because we tend to think, I think, of the two-party system as being very durable and splits as being very unlikely to come about. And yet, if we go back in the last sort of into the 19th century, there have been major occasions of splits.
Oh, yes.
Can we talk a bit about the significance of those and why they were occurring?
Okay. I mean, splits tend usually to be about a combination of, or in varying kind of significance, about ideology, about fundamental matters of party belief, or about leadership, or about both of those things in some kind of combination. So if you want to think about the really major party divisions, one absolutely crucial one is in 1846, where the Conservative Party divides both over the leadership of Sir Robert Peel and particularly over Peel's determination to repeal the Corn Laws, which are these taxes on which come into play on corn imports into the United Kingdom. And by advocating that, Peel is seen by many of his Conservative Party as fundamentally betraying the essence of what the Conservative Party is about, which is the defence of British agriculture. And then you have in 1886 the split in the Liberal Party, when the Liberal leader Gladstone insists on pursuing the policy of Irish Home Rule, giving Ireland self-government, or devolution on the kind of Scottish model as we might think of it today. And about a third of his parliamentary party just will not wear this. And in 1886 this leads to them leaving and forming a separate Liberal Unionist Party. And those are the two really major splits of the 19th century.
And how serious an effect do those splits have on the parties concerned? Does it take a long time for them to recover? Do the splits enable a reverse of the policy that the splitters don't want?
Well, I mean, both splits were had very serious consequences for the parties involved. The Conservatives split in 1846 over the Corn Laws, and effectively Peel and most of the leadership divide from the mass of the Conservative MPs and their followers. The Conservatives who are left behind in the party aren't actually able to win a majority at a general election again until 1874. So they do, they have to form some brief minority governments, but they're not actually able to win a general election for another 28 years. The Liberal Party splits over Home Rule in 1886, and about a third of the MPs leave and become the Liberal Unionist Party, which then becomes effectively an ally of the Conservatives. The Liberals who remain under Gladstone's leadership, usually known as the Gladstonian Liberals, they're not able to win another general election until 1906, I mean 20 years later. So it has immensely serious consequences for those parties. And the people who leave, the followers of Peel in 1846, the Liberal Unionists in 1886, are not able to grow into major political parties. They remain kind of fragments of the political system, and they end up essentially merging with other political groups. So it's not necessarily a happy outcome for anybody.
Do they anticipate that? I mean, the splitters, do they anticipate the fact that they'll end up in this sort of limbo when they go? Or do they think that it will be possible to, you know, do they anticipate a kind of realignment and the possibility of a new party grouping or a permanent force with power in Parliament?
Well, it's difficult to say. Both in 1846 and 1886, there were many attempts on both occasions to actually stop this outcome happening. And there's a kind of wealth of possibilities that might have happened after both 1846 and 1886. I mean, there are many people who wanted, on both occasions, to reunite, you know, the Conservative Party in 1846 and the Liberals in 1886. It just doesn't come about. It might have done in slightly different circumstances. I think once the people who've split away face the fact that is not going to happen, what almost unavoidably and at different speeds tends to happen, of course, is they get drawn over to the other side of the political spectrum. And many prominent followers of Peel, like Gladstone himself, actually end up in the Liberal Party, the Conservatives' main opponents, after the split of 1846. After 1886, most of the Liberal Unionists who leave end up effectively in alliance with the Conservative Party, certainly by 1895. So, if you like, whatever future they may have envisaged for themselves as a third grouping doesn't prove sustainable.
Does that mean, then, that there is a change in the character of the other party? as a result of this? Do they manage, or do they, in a sense, compromise their own or change their own original principles in order to find a way to sustain a political career?
Well, both. Both. I mean, I think you could certainly argue that the Peelites and the followers of Robert Peel, who ended up in the Liberal Party in the 1850s and 1860s, had an important influence on the Liberal leadership. And indeed, Gladstone, who becomes the great Liberal leader of the 1860s, 1870s, 1880s, 1890s, had originally been a Peelite. Similarly, you could certainly argue that the Liberal Unionists had an important impact on the Conservative Party in drawing it more towards the political centre and allowing the Conservative leader, Salisbury, to marginalise some of the more kind of reactionary elements in his party. And he was always saying to his followers, well, I'd love to do this, but the Liberal Unionists would never wear it, you know.
Does that mean you get sort of negativity towards, dislike of these incomers on the part of the, I mean, for example, the more right-wing members, perhaps, of Salisbury's party?
Definitely, definitely. And I think many Conservatives disliked the Liberal Unionists because they felt that they were people who had abandoned long-standing colleagues. They disliked them because they were, in many cases, slightly different socially from the Conservative leadership. Particularly disliked many of them for being religious nonconformists rather than members of the Church of England, and certainly felt that they didn't uphold core Conservative values, that they weren't interested in maintaining the political role of landowners, that they weren't dedicated to the defence of the Church of England. Yeah, and were very deeply suspicious of them. And that only kind of, you know, wears off over a kind of, you know, 20, 30 year period. That is, assuming that he's got any, though never nurtured in the lap of luxury, yet I admonish you, I am an intellectual chap, and think of things that would astonish you. Think it's comical, fa-la-la, fa-la-la, how nature always does contrive, fa-la-la-la, that every boy and every girl that's born into the world alive is either a little liberal or else a little brain and cerebellum too. They've got to leave that brain outside and vote just as their leaders tell them to. But then the prospect of a lot of dull MPs in close proximity, all thinking for themselves, is what no man can face with equanimity. Then let's rejoice with a loud fa-la-la, 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 that nature always does contrive, fa-la-la. Either a little liberal or else a little conservative. Fa-la-la, fa-la-la.
taking it for all he's worth there in Gilbert Sullivan's All Night Long a Chap Remains on Century Go to Chase Monotony, I think, from Ireland-thy, and harking back to perhaps a simpler political time, or at least before the Liberal Unionists had split away. But we're going to bring the discussion a bit more closer to the present time now by turning to our third panellist, Andrew Dufty. And I thought we might start by just thinking about perhaps the most recent major split in British politics, which is, of course, the SDP breaking away from the Labour Party. Do you think that had, you know, can we put that in a similar framing as the 19th century splits that Ian was talking about?
I think so, and there are certainly some parallels to what we see going on now, but also some significant differences too. So it certainly was a split, fairly small to begin with. In 1981, it could have looked like a splinter, but certainly more people followed. So the gang of four, David Owen, Shirley Williams, Bill Rogers and Roy Jenkins, left. They were really opposed to the kind of leftward shift in Labour Party politics at the time. And also, interestingly, another interesting kind of parallel to now, they were opposed to what was going on in local government at the time, where there were moves to deselect some of the more moderate centrist Labour councillors and replace them with others that were favoured by the Labour leadership. And interestingly, actually, in contrast to what's happened now, what they immediately did was sort of set up a new political party. So this was not an independent group. So they were very quick to set up the Social Democratic Party. And quite a number of other MPs followed them effectively across the floor. So four of them went, but they were followed then by another 25 MPs who really in the space of about 12 months defected. 24 of those were Labour MPs, so this is really a Labour split. Only one of them was a Conservative MP, and in that sense it's somewhat different to the present day.
And did it have long-term effects, do you think? Was it, how significant a moment was it?
Well, I mean, it's interesting, to come back to Ian's point, actually what happens when a split happens is it allows the leadership to try and consolidate. It takes a group away from a political party, and that's perhaps helpful to the leadership. So it's a very long time after the SDP split before Labour gets any kind of electoral traction, and really the party only moves back to the centre ground under Blair. So in a sense, it doesn't impact on Labour politics, and that's because it takes that moderate voice out of the Labour Party. On the other hand, it does have a significant impact on Liberal politics in the UK. So not only do they form a political party, but they realise the difficulties of political parties getting traction in the UK electoral system. So they form an alliance with the Liberal Party. So the SDP Liberal Alliance then fights the next two general elections and actually does rather well, at least in terms of getting votes. They don't do so well in terms of getting seats, but so it does have an impact on it. And the long-term consequences of that, eventually the merger, which leads to the Liberal Democrats that we have today, who do really very well indeed in 1997 and then in 2010 end up in government. So.
And so would that raise questions about the idea? Because one often thinks of it as being sort of the kiss of death to split a party that the system doesn't, you know, isn't set up to allow for third parties to do very well within it, that Parliament isn't perhaps set up to give much space to smaller groupings. But are there perhaps ways in which, in fact, that isn't so much the case?
Yes, so the received wisdom is that divided political parties don't do very well, so splits are bad for the party that's left, the rump, and also splits don't really work for the people leaving. The splitters, because the UK electoral system doesn't really discriminates against third parties. And there's certainly strong arguments for both of those cases. So when we've seen, when we've had fundamentally divided political parties in the UK, Labour in the 1980s and the Conservatives, who were divided over Europe as they are now in the 1990s, they struggle to make electoral gains. So that certainly appears to be the case. The electoral system certainly does discriminate against smaller parties. And actually, the SDP Liberal Alliance is one of the prime examples of that. So in 1983, the SDP Liberal Alliance won about 25% of the vote. They only were about 2% behind Labour in terms of share of the vote. But they only win 23 seats in Parliament, and Labour wins over 200. So the system doesn't work. And actually, more recently, UKIP in 2015, 4 million votes, 12.6% of the vote, and all that delivers for them is one Member of Parliament. So the electoral system is a significant break against smaller parties breaking through. On the other hand, actually, to bring back to a point Ian's already made, the electoral system also means that UK political parties are broad churches. And there are always divisions in UK political parties. And they do quite well despite those divisions, so they're not necessarily an electoral break on them. So the Labour Party's fairly fundamentally divided between the Brownites and the Blairites in the 1990s and early 2000s, but they still managed to win three general elections. The Conservatives are fundamentally divided in the 1980s, but they still managed to win general elections. And with regard to the smaller parties, the electoral fortunes of smaller parties, it is the case that the system, undoubtedly the system discriminates against smaller parties. It's a majoritarian electoral system. On the other hand, I think we're seeing some fundamental shifting in voting behaviour in the UK in the last 10 years or so. So because we have a system that discriminates against third parties, really, the idea of the system is to discourage us from voting for parties other than the main two. And that's what we did for most of the post-war years. More than 90% of the electorate voted Labour or Conservative. But that's been changing over the last 10 years or so. So actually, despite having an electoral system which discriminates against smaller parties or third parties, people are going out in their millions and voting for these other parties. So it is possible to gain electoral traction as a small and entryist party under the current system.
Do you have any thoughts on what's triggering that change? I mean, is it that the offer from smaller groupings has improved, that their techniques for connecting with the electorate have changed, or is it actually that the mentality of the electorate has altered?
I think it might be both of those things. There are other factors in play too. There's a kind of broader trend towards partisan de-alignment. So this idea that the traditional parties no longer reflect where we are. We don't think of ourselves as being upper class or middle class and working class anymore. So we get, there always were working class Conservative voters, but that model for dividing up the voters doesn't seem to work anymore. But there are other factors at play here. Also, the changes in voting across the UK. So the creation of devolved assemblies in Scotland and Wales and Northern Ireland have really given a boost to a range of parties in the different parts of the UK who were able to attract votes in elections to the devolved assemblies. And consequently, people go on and vote for them in general elections too. And then the issues that people care about. One of the constant complaints we often hear from students, actually, is that the political parties are all the same. So if you get a party that comes along and tries to disrupt that, like UKIP, and tries to take Britain down a different path, there's potential for them to get support there. People are prepared to vote on single issues.
Does that also mean, therefore, that it isn't so much... Because my recollection is that the SDP, a lot of those MPs who cross over are then defeated at the subsequent general election. So it is a career, it's not very good for careers.
Yeah.
Has that dynamic then changed a bit, do you think?
Well, I don't know, because we haven't seen anything quite like this, but you're absolutely right. So that there might be long-term changes that take place, but I think the prospects for those 11 independent group MPs who've left the Conservatives and Labour are not... Their short-term electoral prospects, at least based on past history, is not great. So of the 29 SDP MPs who... MPs who defected to the SDP in 81, only four of them managed to hold on to their seats in the 1983 general election. So I think it would need to be a significant change to see it. If the independent group, and it's not a political party, it's a significant point, if the independent group is going to have some kind of electoral traction, there probably needs to be more of them. And in the short term, at least, they probably need to expect to lose their seats in at least a significant proportion of them.
I'm breaking down, gonna start from scratch. Shake it off like an etch-a-sketch. My lips are saying goodbye. My eyes are finally dry. I'm not the way that I used to be. I took the record off repeat. It killed me, but I survived. And now
Fifth Harmony, Miss Moving On, doubtless expressing the sentiments of Theresa May on her return with her newly improved deal. But we should not get too deeply into the rights and wrongs of that. So, come to the point of the programme now, we try to draw some of the threads together. And one of the things that struck me was coming out of a lot of the discussion so far was this question of how these different groups choose to organise themselves or not organise themselves once they've broken away. And we were just discussing, well, the song was playing about the distinction that the independent group have drawn between, you know, the moment they're still just a grouping, they're not a party. And I was going to just ask Philippa, first of all, you were mentioning the fact that there are all these sort of individualist barons floating around. I was just wondering what it was like in, or what we know about what it was like in parliamentary meetings in your period. To what extent are they organised, you know, how are they organising themselves? Do they organise themselves? Can you say a little bit about that?
Well, to an extent, they are individuals. That's what they're there to be. The concept is not that they form a grouping, but they do have a distinct impression of themselves as the advisers of the king, the king's natural advisers, the people who have a right to tell the king what they think. And so they work in that sort of basis. The other way that they tend to organise themselves increasingly in the late 13th century is by the spiritual lords, the bishops, who have their own concerns, and the secular lords, who have a completely different set of concerns. So you begin to see how those two things don't work together as well.
At least we're not yet in a religious war, I suppose. That's thankful for small mercies. Do you think, Andrew, that the independent group will have to organise themselves into a party, or why do you think they're choosing not to at the moment? Are they hoping to go back?
I don't know what their hopes or indeed their intentions are, but I'm not sure it's necessary for them to form themselves into a political party. I already mentioned that those Labour MPs who formed the STP very quickly decided that they needed a political party. And we seem to be locked into this idea in the UK that the political parties are really the only way of mobilising support. But actually, there might be some value in them remaining as independents, as a loose group of independents. So it was quite common in the 19th century to have independent MPs. It's really only since the kind of mid-19th century that political parties have become the principal vehicle. But actually, we can look across British politics and see independents at work at all kinds of different levels. So if we look in local government in the UK, there are about 1,800 independent local councillors in the UK. And people went out and voted for them as independent. If you look in the House of Lords, there are 151 crossbench peers, you know, who are valued for their independence. And there's even a significant group now of independent members of the House of Commons. There's 21. Now, they're independent, some of them not by choice, but there's a significant group there, and some of whom have chosen to remain as independent. So I think perhaps their unique selling point may be their independence. Once they start forming a party, they might have to be a bit more coherent about what they want, and also about leadership and those kind of things. So there might be some electoral traction in remaining as a group of independents.
Ian, do you think that means that actually there's been a kind of a stronger tradition of kind of independent action in politics, or you know, is this sort of idea we have of it being defined by the formation of parties, and particularly a two-party system, is that actually not perhaps a fully accurate reading of it?
Well, I think there is a kind of fundamental idea about looking at British politics in the 19th century and saying how did this very long-standing and old-fashioned parliamentary system, which goes all the way back to the Middle Ages, How did it evolve into something equating a modern democracy? And one of the ways in which it did that was obviously to give more people the vote. But another way in which it did that was to try and make that vote meaningful, so that you weren't just electing a local representative. You, by casting your vote in a general election, you were making a decision about who was going to form the next government. And you can say that what the two-party system did was to allow local voters that meaningful choice, because they weren't just electing an MP who was going to go to Parliament and behave independently. They were electing a representative of a party, and one of those two parties was going to form the government. So you could say that the evolution of the mass two-party system allowed local voters much more power over government, at least allowed them to decide which one of two parties would form the government. And I think that's been a very, very long-standing idea in British politics, that there are all sorts of disadvantages to parties, but they have been crucial to the evolution of democracy. So if we went back to a system of many more kind of independents and many more kind of smaller groupings in Parliament, although that might in some ways be admirable in the sense of politicians actually having to make fewer compromises to their beliefs to stick together in two bigger parties, it might actually mean that ordinary voters actually had rather less influence over the composition of the government.
Sorry, do you want to come in?
Yeah.
Well, I think Ian's absolutely right. The only problem with that is I'm not sure that voters in constituencies feel like that the main parties are providing that form of representation anymore. So actually they may feel more inclined to vote for an individual who claims to appeal to their particular needs in their constituency or their particular views. And this idea that a mass political party is representing them is not really there.
I'm just going to come back to this in a second, but I just occurs to me to ask Philippa whether there's any angst among people in your period as they're forming into these, whether they're forming into a group as advisors to the king and sort of opponents of that group, or forming into the temporal and spiritual division that you mentioned. Is there any worry about that group formation process, about kind of the loss of individualism that we were talking about before? Does that figure as an issue in any sense?
No, I don't think it does, because I don't think it has occurred to them that they are forming something long term. Because Parliament is not something that sits all the time. It only sits when it's asked. It only sits in emergency situations. They aren't very clear that this is going to happen next year and the year after, even if it then goes on to do so.
And are they still operating? Do they operate sort of spheres of influence with the King when the Parliament isn't sitting? Or does he get to go off on his own and just sort of carry on independently in those periods?
He should ask his advisers, but he should summon Parliament to do it. If you are at court, and whether you're at court or not might depend on your income, who you are, then you may try to have an influence upon the king, and that will be both the bishops and the secular lords. But really, the point is that the king should take advice, but he should take it by calling Parliament.
It's quite interesting. One thinks that we've moved a long way from all this, and then you start to think about all the debates at the moment about whether or not Parliament is being appropriately consulted. We were talking a moment ago about the increase in the number of independent, single individual MPs almost, and also about the sort of mixed range of people within the independent group and the complexities that might follow if they wanted to form into a more coherent grouping. To what extent do you think that these increasing number of single figures have been able to, you know, without even a group to support them, have been able to exert any kind of leverage over policy or over the direction of parties, or have they found themselves very much to be sort of isolated within the system? Because again, one thinks of not only the electoral system but also Parliament as being structured in a way to work for the parties and not perhaps for individuals outside those groupings.
Parliament is constructed on the basis that political parties are the dominant vehicle. So the independent group and independent MPs do find it very difficult at a whole range of levels. Will they be called to speak in debate? The chances are they'll be called to speak quite late in debate. Their time might be quite limited at that point. They might struggle to get places on public bill committees, so their influence on legislation is likely to be limited too. We've seen some pressure on the independent group, in fact, on earlier this week, in terms of trying the Labour Party trying to remove their former MPs from the Foreign Affairs Select Committee. And actually some of those independent group MPs have quite prominent positions, notably Sarah Wollaston is chair of the Health Select Committee and also chair of the Liaison Committee. Now, she was a Conservative MP, and the Conservatives haven't made any moves to remove her yet, but that might very well come. So they're in quite prominent positions, some of them, but they might struggle to retain those positions too. So it is quite hard for independent MPs to have some kind of impact in Parliament.
And of course, the thing which helps you is if the government doesn't have a clear majority, and that's when you can perhaps try and achieve some more leverage. If one party has a clear majority in the House of Commons, I think it's very difficult for an independent grouping. There might be more opportunities in the current situation where there's a lot of really tight kind of parliamentary votes, and of course both the major parties are quite divided about a whole range of things.
Yes, that's right.
Can just on this question of removing individuals from particular roles, can the major parties sort of do that just by fiat because there's more of them, or is there room for manoeuvre for those individuals?
It's not clear what might happen, but the role of the parties and the party leadership in appointing members of select committees in particular has been significantly limited by recent reforms. So chairs of select committees are now elected by the House as a whole, and members of select committees are elected by their party members. So they elect their party members' seats on the. So actually, it means the committee members have a significant personal mandate in that they've been put there as individuals. And actually, Labour's attempt to remove two of its former members from the Foreign Affairs Committee was objected to, and therefore won't go forward. But I think the Procedure Committee is going to look at that, so we might see what happens. But actually, in the past, when membership of select committees was in the hands of the party whips, it would be relatively easy to try and strangle the party, the independent group at birth, if you like. But it's much more difficult now. Parliament itself has more power.
So in fact, that again, it's another way in which there's been a loosening, perhaps, of the control that comes through the two-party system.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right, yeah.
One of the other things, one very quick final question. There's been this view that, in some quarters, that MPs who've changed party or left party should run for re-election to see what the view of the public is. And I was wondering whether, did that apply to what extent are there elections going on in your period? Did any kind of public pressure around potential change of opinion apply? And again, in the 19th century, was there the same kind of pressures showing through?
No. There were not really elections. Occasionally, people are asked to choose representatives of the county to attend Parliament, but that's a very sort of innovative idea in the 1260s. No one's quite sure what it means, and sometimes they send people and sometimes they don't because they can't work it out. But no, it's not about election. It's about having a right almost by birth.
I think in the 19th century, I mean, overwhelmingly not. You know, people thought if they changed their allegiance, then that would be a matter that would be decided by the electorate at the next general election. And mostly they did not feel any pressure to stand down immediately and put themselves up for re-election.
And actually only one of the new SDP MPs stood down and forced a by-election in 1982, and he lost his seat. So it's probably not a good move to take.
But there's not perhaps the level of precedent that we might. This kind of implication at the moment that the precedent is in favour of elections is perhaps not as strong as we might think. Or plenty of them have refused to do it.
Don't forget now, if the electorate are really unhappy with what their MP has done, they can always get up a petition. And if 10%, is it 10% of the electorate sign it?
But I don't think you can have a recall position if your MP changes party. It has to be, they have to be guilty of some kind of wrongdoing.
Of course, some might say that was, but perhaps not. Anyway, I think we have come to the end of our time again on this edition of Past Prologue. I'd like to thank my three guests, Philip Hoskin, Ian Packer and Andrew Defty, for guiding us through the maze of party splits and rebellious barons and confusion about political futures, which will no doubt may or may not be resolved by the time you hear this show. And in the meantime, we shall go out with a topical ABBA song, I think, and we'll hope to be back with you in about a month's time.
emptiness.